Makeshift Stories presents Somewhere, Sometime, an irregular series of short bedtime tales and modern fables.
In ancient times, the appearance of a comet was considered a bad omen, the death of a king, or the sign of a coming catastrophe. In this month's story, set in the recent past, a scientific mission to the comet Hale-Bopp brings an unexpected discovery that might justify our ancestors' concerns. Now, sit back, close your eyes, and open your imagination as we listen to Makeshift Stories 45, Hale-Bopp. Somewhere in some time, there might have been a comet that was a bearer of unexpected truths.
Cyrus slid into the back of the hot, crowded boardroom, expecting a party. Instead, he found the science team somberly staring at a real-time 3D projection of the comet they were chasing, tentatively hovering over the tiny, worn-out conference table. Luminescent feathers of ice and dust streamed from its core, forming the beginnings of a coma. If the infant jets had been fanned wider, Cyrus mused, the thing would have looked like the cosmic equivalent of a peacock. But they had all seen this view many times before, so he didn't understand why no one had bothered to acknowledge his presence. Irritated by their indifference, Cyrus decided to check the date on the ship's chronometer. He linked into the local net and watched as a date overlay on the somber scene. December 21, 1996, 4:13 p.m., GMT. He requested confirmation, and the date dutifully blinked unchanged in the corner of his vision. Cyrus could feel the anger and disappointment well up. His face turned red as he thought about the unexplainable series of rejections and snubs that had culminated in this moment. He had wanted, no, had been desperate to study astrophysics at the prestigious University of Susa, which ran the famous Deep Space Observatory orbiting Alpha Centauri B. All new students admitted to the program were given at least one solar year at the facility, which was where most of Persia's significant deep space discoveries were being made now. It was a plum posting that all recently ascended students in cosmological studies hoped for. Service on the station almost guaranteed that a generous benefactor would back one's studies, and future jobs would be plentiful. Cyrus had the highest grades in the state, and recommendations from the most influential academics in his home city. Normally, he would have received an automatic placement at Susa, but for reasons Cyrus could not comprehend, the ancient patriarch of space research, Fath Shah, was head of the now mostly ceremonial Institute of Solar Studies in Babylon, had intervened, and Cyrus had been assigned as his assistant instead. The ISS was an ancient organization that had been set up by the Ministry of Science after the first successful robotic exploration of the moon in 1496, and had been at the center of Persia's space effort until the Chinese had humiliated the venerable organization by establishing the first extrasolar colony on S-333-D some 300 years later. It was a humiliation to all of the states of the Persian Federation, one which the ISS never recovered from. So now, an assignment there was a sentence into irrelevance. And that was how Cyrus found himself on this routine reconnaissance to the newly discovered comet Hale-Bopp, and why he was leaning unnoticed against a bulkhead, fuming about his fate. What new could they possibly learn, he lamented. There have been dozens, if not hundreds, of comet missions over the centuries. Cyrus felt his anger well up again. It would take years of laborious and tedious research to get reassigned, and even if that were possible, the dark shame of the ISS would stick to him like glue. Even then, he had heard that Fath Shah was almost impossible to get out from under. So to Cyrus, his future looked dim indeed. He felt like his career had come to an end before it had even started. Now, to add insult to injury, the entire crew had forgotten his ascension celebration. The most important date in a young Persian's life, ignored, Cyrus lamented, in order to study the first long-distance scans of this unnotable run-of-the-mill comet. After it passed perihelion and vanished from the Earth's skies into the frozen darkness of space, Cyrus knew it would be quickly forgotten, and their observations archived on red in some inaccessible data hive in the basement of the Institute. Fath Shah, who had been sitting in a darkened corner of the room, looked away from the slowly rotating holographic comet to the open hatch where Cyrus slumped against the bulkhead, balling his hands into fists. Ignoring his young assistant's irritation, he enthusiastically motioned him over to an empty chair beside him. Cyrus had been the brightest student to come to his attention in decades, and Fath had to use all his remaining influence to get him into the ISS. He knew Cyrus resented him for that. These days, the Institute's reputation had sunk to a new low, and even mediocre students from the hinterlands of the Federated States dreaded a posting to it. But Fath's discovery of Hale-Bopp, and more specifically the eccentricity of its rotation, offered a chance for the Institute to at least partly regain its ancient status. Fath could not afford to let the opportunity slide by, however equally he was not quite ready to reveal what he suspected. He, and more specifically the Institute, could not afford to be wrong about such a radical conclusion. So Fath had done whatever was needed to get the best resources to help him confirm it. The hurt feelings of a promising young scientist was, unfortunately, an insignificant consequence that could be dealt with later. Cyrus slid into the crowded room, but defiantly stood beside his mentor, and in his mind abductor, instead of sitting.
"Cyrus,"
Fath quietly whispered in the young man's ear.
"We've confirmed that there have been no outside factors that would have caused its recent behavior."
Fath wanly smiled at the sullen figure of Cyrus. If only he could tell him, but Fath knew he wouldn't believe it. Cyrus would have to come to the same conclusion on his own, and now Fath decided it was time for him to start.
"The rotational period has continued to change since Hale-Bopp crossed Jupiter's orbit. Cyrus, I'd like you to look at the data and project how much it will slow down."
Without glancing at Fath, Cyrus resentfully spat back. "I'm sure that you've already done that, sir, so with respect, I don't see the point. Is this just busy work the ISS routinely assigns new draftees to keep him out of the director's hair? Some ancient, ridiculous custom that has, no doubt, helped contribute to the Institute's current sorry state?" The director patiently held up a hand.
"Humor an old man. I need someone to independently confirm my calculations. And I'd like to hear your speculations on the cause."
"Look, I don't need to run a projection to tell you. I can do that now. We'll eventually discover a gas jet that the Institute's shoddy, outdated equipment couldn't spot." Fath ignored the rude comment.
"Cyrus, I've granted you access to my personal observational data. Let's meet, say, after lunch tomorrow in the observatory module. That should give you adequate time."
Without giving Cyrus a chance to respond, Fath wedged himself out of his seat, squeezed around the stooped researchers, and left for his cabin. "Adequate time?" Cyrus angrily muttered at the director's receding back. "I'll be up all night just to run the data." Cyrus hovered for a few moments at the back of the room, then decided he was wasting his time watching the vapid holocomet projection, and launched himself out of the wardroom behind the obstinate director. He was in no mood to talk to anyone, so instead of making his way to the analytics room to perform his demeaning assignment, he decided to retrieve the data from his cabin. Data analysis was usually something assigned to untalented juniors, so Cyrus wondered how many of the assistants in the wardroom had overheard Fath's order. He suspected that if they did, they were now probably laughing at him behind his back. The insult rolled around in his mind, making him angrier and more determined than ever to somehow escape from the Institute. Why had Fath insisted on him joining the ISS anyway, only to demean him by assigning such a low-level task? Was there something in his family's history he was brought here to atone for? Why, he asked himself in frustration as he squeezed into his tiny cabin. Humiliated and confused, Cyrus threw himself on his bunk, then, with a huff of resignation, connected to the ship's net, calling up the analytic engine and commanding it to collect Fath's private data, using the access codes he found waiting in his message queue. He waited as the AE found the data, gave the search engine parameters for the analysis, and reduced the process to an icon in the corner of his vision. Expecting the analytic engine to take a while to finish its task, he called up the history files on the Institute and started to look through them for a clue that would explain Fath's actions. Briefly, he considered having the AE run a correlation analysis between his family history and the Institute's, but decided against that in case Fath monitored analytic engine use, which Cyrus suspected he did. The files closely followed the official history, noting the usual milestones: the formation of the Institute in 1498 to take on the stewardship of space exploration from the Persian Imperial Air Corps. The long lists of firsts it quickly accumulated: the first robotic exploration of Mars in 1505, the first continually occupied space station in 1510, the first humans on the moon in 1515, etc. The name of one of the moon crew caught Cyrus's attention. She was an ancient relative of Fath Shah, who, on retirement from the Space Corps, had become the first director of human spaceflight. No doubt, Cyrus angrily thought, Fath's family had presided over the great disgrace, and through bad management had let the Chinese surpass Persian accomplishments in the late 1700s. More recently, they would have been involved in the debacle that saw the seat of Persian space exploration move to Susa. At the time, Persian deep space research had been unexpectedly and spectacularly eclipsed by the Mayan discoveries from their array in orbit around Pollux. But there was nothing Cyrus could find that associated an ancient relative of his to the Institute or its downfall. He was about to search through Fath's official dossier when the process icon pulsed in the corner of his vision, indicating that the first part of the data analysis was complete. That surprised Cyrus. Making sense of data from a chaotic system like a comet should have taken hours. He dismissed the files on Fath, asking the ship's net to place a copy in his local storage. He'd read them later, then opened the analytic engine's report. To his surprise, the first graph showed a controlled deceleration in the spin of the comet's nucleus. The line gently flattened to the horizontal at one rotation per day, but just not one rotation every 24 hours, rather, one rotation in exactly 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4.09053083288 seconds, the exact rotational period of the Earth to the millisecond. Taken aback, Cyrus quickly checked the spectral analysis to see if there had been eruptions of gas jets that could account for the change in rotation. And, as he expected, indeed there had been. But they were far from random occurrences. They appeared to have been precisely timed, like the RC thrusters on an ancient spacecraft. Cyrus fell back into his tiny chair, his heart pounding against his ribs. He sat still, staring into space, stunned by the implications. Was this why the old man wouldn't tell him anything? Was this why Fath had fought to force him into the ISS? And how long had the old conniving weasel known? Fath sat at the far end of the observatory, poring through new data that hovered in the air before him. He was so immersed in the analysis that he didn't notice when Cyrus arrived. The thin young assistant had slipped into the observatory and stood silently staring at the ever-changing streams of figures. Fath looked up and saw him, but wasn't sure how long Cyrus had been there. "Is that more secret data from your personal stash?" Cyrus almost growled. Fath ignored him while he finished making an adjustment to one of the formulas, then looked away from the swirling graphs and numbers to confront Cyrus's accusing gaze. "New data," he casually commented. "You are the first to see it besides me." Cyrus impatiently shot back. "How long have you suspected?" Fath casually shrugged and gestured for Cyrus to take a seat.
"I'm not sure what it is that you think I'm supposed to suspect."
"Obviously, the rotational slowdown. What else?" Cyrus added. "How long have you known it couldn't possibly be a natural event?"
"That, Cyrus, is what brought us here. And that is why I needed the best people, like you. Hopefully now you can understand the need for discretion. Remember, is only conjecture until it can be confirmed. The last thing the Institute needs is to be wrong again. It can't sustain another failure. So for now, only you and I can see the data. I promise, Cyrus. If this is confirmed, it will more than make up for your loss of your assignment on Centauri B. If we are right, you might even one day become the director of Centauri B.
Fath smiled, turned back to the holodata, and muttered more to himself than to Cyrus.
And, if we are right, the Institute will regain its rightful status.
Cyrus was left with an odd mixture of excitement and lingering resentment. It was an amazing opportunity, but he could not forgive Fath for forcing him to come here, at least not yet. Not until their hypothesis was confirmed. And if it wasn't? If there was a natural explanation? He put the thought out of his mind for the present. Cyrus was shaken from a dream by the shrill shriek of the ship's alarm. He started to jump up, then remembered it was a signal for all crew to strap in for the final maneuvers that would bring the aging research craft into orbit around the comet's nucleus. It had been 3 weeks since his secret discussion with Fath, and the other research assistants had yet to notice anything unusual. Cyrus decided that Fath had either hidden the data well, or had chosen people who were not inquisitive enough to bother looking at it. He lay back in his bunk thinking, and reluctantly let the automatic restraint system spin its protective web over him, which was, he later realized when the ship went through a series of sudden direction and velocity changes, really needed. After what seemed like an impossibly long period of time, the scanners finally completed their mapping run, and a potato-shaped nucleus, 18 kilometers long and 7.5 across, resolved in the air above the conference table. It lazily rotated in sync with its real twin less than 100 kilometers away. Hale-Bopp's surface reminded Cyrus of a weird frozen kid's treat, an erratic jumble of ice and dark rock with a large meteor impact on one side. Fath scoured the hollow, pacing around the table, impatiently pushing assistants and techs out of his way. On his third orbit of the virtual comet, Fath suddenly stopped and pointed.
There. Give me the thermal.
Two techs gestured intensely in the air in front of them, making the hollow obediently shift to cool blues, except for what looked like a spiderweb of veins beneath Fath's outstretched finger. Cyrus had been expecting something less organic, like a circle or polygon, and wasn't convinced. But Fath announced in a commanding tone,
"We land there."
Cyrus pulled him aside and whispered, "Are you sure? That looks like a natural structure." Irritated, Fath replied,
"It's the only place there's a difference in surface temperature, and it's where the ridgelines converge. Obviously, it might be a heat sink of some sort. Or was."
Cyrus gave him a questioning look.
"Come on, a radiator, must I spell it out for you? You don't think there would have been a sign that said, 'Look here,' conveniently posted for us to find, do you?"
Cyrus bit back his reaction. The old man could be very demeaning. And why wouldn't there be a more obvious sign? However, Cyrus decided to say nothing as Fath turned his attention to the other crew.
"There will only be three in the landing party,"
Fath was saying.
"Daria will pilot and stay posted at the lander. Cyrus and myself will do the excursion. We launch in 6 hours.
The crowd in the room obediently began to disperse in order to prepare. Despite his review of hundreds of VR recordings of asteroid landings, Cyrus was not prepared for the effects of microgravity and felt his stomach's contents rise in his throat as he looked out of the clear bubble of the lander's crew module. They appeared to be dropping headfirst onto the icy chaotic surface of Hale-Bopp. Jets of gas and debris were already starting to vent from the barren microworld as it dove inexorably toward the inner solar system. In another week there would be too much dust and ice liberating itself from the surface to safely approach. The mission had been precisely planned to rendezvous with the comet at the closest point to Earth that was still far enough away from the sun to allow a team to, more or less, land safely on the surface. Cyrus closed his eyes as their pilot deftly rotated the lander at the last moment.
firing a burst of the main thruster to slow the vehicle down enough so it wouldn't bounce off the surface. The craft had barely kissed the ice when three soft thuds indicated that the harpoons had successfully fired, tethering the spider-like machine to the surface.
"We're down and secure. Seal your visors. I'm depressurizing the cabin,"
Daria announced. The lander was too small to have an airlock. As Cyrus and Fath unbuckled their restraints, Daria issued one more reminder.
"Now be careful out there. I don't want to be chasing after you if you accidentally launch yourself off the surface."
With that sobering warning hanging in the vacuum of the cabin, the hatch slid open, and Fath and Cyrus worked their way out through the narrow opening, carefully jumped, and floated down to the delicate surface. Cyrus stood for a few moments, taking in the view of this tiny Arctic world, trying to envision the nightmare of jetting gas and dust that would soon envelop it. His daydream was rudely broken by Fath's impatient tinny voice in his ear.
"Cyrus, this isn't a sightseeing tour. We've got too much to do. Come over here. I've found what looks like an opening."
Cyrus instinctively held a gloved hand below his visor to reduce the glare reflecting off the bright surface. Spotting Fath standing in the shadow of one of the nearby ridges, he cautiously made his way over to the director, who was already entering what looked like a shallow cave in the ridge wall. Cyrus reluctantly followed, flicking on his helmet lights to illuminate the dark passage. The interior was organically shaped, but oddly artificial, like a fake rock wall in a theme park that Cyrus had once visited. Fath stopped at the cave's end and traced his hand along a seam that appeared to form an irregular-shaped hatch until he found a small protrusion sticking out of the ice wall. He pressed it and in tense silence waited. When nothing happened, Cyrus impatiently pushed Fath's hand away and pointed the laser cutter he had taken from his belt at the spot. A brief pulse from the tool immediately sublimated the ice into a puff of invisible gas, exposing a release mechanism below. Cyrus motioned for Fath to try again. This time the hatch slid open, releasing a small cloud of frozen ice particles. Fath and Cyrus stepped through the threshold. Once inside, the hatch automatically slid closed again, and after a few moments, Cyrus thought he could feel the rumblings of motors through the soles of his boots. An inner door swung open, revealing a long tunnel.
"Airlock,"
Fath muttered in his mic.
"But my suit environmentals say we're still in vacuum. There must be a breach somewhere ahead."
The walls of the tunnel had a soft luminescence that was bright enough to make helmet lights unnecessary as Fath and Cyrus made their way along the tunnel. They walked for another 15 minutes before coming to a Y junction. The branch to the left opened into a large chamber that had been violently dissected by the crater they had seen on the hollow map.
"You're breached, sir,"
Cyrus sarcastically radioed. Fath ignored him, replying,
"This means the structure is older than the impact."
Cyrus followed Fath into the ruins of what looked to have been a huge warehouse. Most of the place had been vaporized by the force of the impact. Only a few broken remnants of what looked like rows of hollow tubes had survived. Somewhat disappointed, Cyrus turned to Fath and spoke.
"This might be enough to convince most people, but I have to admit I was really hoping for more."
"Don't give up so easily, Cyrus,"
Fath encouragingly replied.
"Hellbop is performing a controlled change in his rotational speed, so at minimum, the control mechanism must still be intact. Let's try another tunnel."
45 minutes later, Fath and Cyrus found themselves standing in what could only be described as a circular theater. And although they had searched its walls for what seemed like hours looking for another hatch, they couldn't find one. They had been ready to leave when Fath had decided to walk down the sloping floor to examine a circle of rough material at the room's center. As soon as his boot touched the roughened area, the hatch through which they had entered closed, and the vacuum seemed to impossibly thicken, then coalesce into a vaguely human presence. Both Fath and Cyrus heard a crackle in their radios.
"Welcome,"
a ghostly shifting form warmly said, in an ancient Persian dialect. Cyrus immediately remembered it from his childhood studies, but it took longer for Fath to recognize and understand the projection. It doggedly repeated,
"We planted the seeds of knowledge in your world, and have waited many millennia for them to bear fruit. And now you are here. So we must assume our efforts have been successful. Let me explain. 12,600 solar orbits of your planet ago, we arrived in your system. Our great generational ship, the asteroid we are now standing on, experienced a major malfunction in its propulsion system that threw us off course and into the gravity well of your star, where we have been trapped ever since. On our first orbit through your system, as we left perihelion, we noticed life on your planet, but there were no technological civilizations that we could contact to help us. So we planned a mission on our next approach, 4,200 planetary orbits later. A small handful of us picked a promising region on your world to assist and landed there while the rest of us slept in the great chamber you passed on the way to this room."
Cyrus and Fath stood in humbled silence as the projection continued. This was not at all what they were expecting. An ancient alien crew in a crippled generational interstellar ship that saw, as their only hope of salvation, interference in the natural development of Earth to bring about a technical society that could help them. But the recording didn't know about the collision that had destroyed the sleeper's gallery. When it ended, Fath slumped down onto the cold stone floor of the theater. The adrenaline of discovery drained out of him. To Cyrus, he looked worn out and frail, so different now from the angry, stern man that had drafted him against his will. Cyrus slowly sank down onto the floor beside the old failing patriarch. Both stared silently into the now empty void, still twitching with the fading remnants of the projection. Fath finally spoke.
"Cyrus, how do you think the citizens of Persia will take the knowledge that we're simply the product of an alien cultural engineering project, whose sole goal was to bring us here to save them? Think of it. Our great and noble society is scientific and cultural achievements planned by an alien agency rather than dreamed of by our own imaginations. And for what end? A futile, desperate scheme that chance has indifferently destroyed. I wonder what the natural course of history would have been had they not intervened."
Cyrus thought about it for several minutes before replying.
"I don't know, Fath. But given the current perception that our culture is being eclipsed and our influence is waning, it may not be wise to make this discovery known."
Fath sighed heavily in agreement.
"Yes, you're right. Unfortunately, I used all the Institute's remaining capital and goodwill to put this mission together, Cyrus. And to get you assigned here, I had to make promises I'm not sure I can keep now. The Institute, and I'm afraid to say myself, have nothing left. I gambled everything on this mission's success. When I planned it, it seemed so safe. It seemed that I couldn't fail. The evidence was so strong. I would be..." He smiled and corrected himself. "No, we would have been the discoverers of the first artificial object not made by humankind. Such a discovery would have saved the Institution and launched you on a sensational career. It was always my intention, Cyrus. But now, hearing this, the cost of that may be too high. I hope you understand what I'm saying. I'm sorry. I'll do what I can to get you posted to Centauri."
Fath fell silent.
"Despite my misgivings about the posting, Fath, I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to have seen this."
Cyrus's words faded away, then a realization suddenly came to him.
"Look, all we really need to do is create a mystery, to create some questions about the nature of the comet. That would give us enough interest to fund further research. Maybe get us time on the Deep Space Observatory. Maybe we could backtrack the ship's path to its origin and claim that we started our search there."
Fath understood, nodding his head in his helmet.
"Yes. Yes, that might work. We can release the data for Hale Bob after it is well on its way back to the Oort cloud. Too far to be practical to send a mission. It might just be enough to find a benefactor for further research."
With renewed energy, Fath got up and called the lander.
excursion team to lander. We have our samples and are returning. There's nothing much here, just an old gas vent from the core.
Thanks for listening to Makeshift Stories 45, Somewhere, Sometime, Hail Bop. We hope you enjoyed the story tonight, and if you did, please tell your friends about us. We'd love to hear from you, so send us an email at makeshiftstories@gmail.com or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. The opening theme, Glimpse of Happiness, is Podsafe Music, licensed from premiumbeat.com. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative License, which means you're free to share our stories. Just remember to credit us and don't change anything.